About the fun computation we did last term with David and Pedro. And the outline for today is the following. So I'll first set up a puzzle in CFT. Then we're going to gather some data in NCOS4 Spring Mills that will be useful to investigate this kind of puzzle. Then we'll apply a magic trick to this data and resolve the puzzle. And then in the end, we'll discuss some open puzzles that require a bit more than magic to solve. So let's consider first some free theory with some scalar phi. Okay. And let's count primary operators, which are composites made out of two phi's and derivatives. Okay. So let's look for primaries of SPNS. So since we're looking for primaries, we can discard total derivatives. And then up to total derivatives, the only composite we can write is phi ds phi. So any operator is total derivatives. Which means that at each SPNS, we have at most one composite of this form. Now, this does not mean we have one new primary at each spin, because we still need to take into account the fact that the operators are identical, and so we should mod out by permutations. And so permutations tell us that this operator is the same as this, or phi acts on the first or the second operator. And then this combined with total derivatives tell you that shuffling the derivatives around gives a minus sign. Tell us that there is no new primary at odd spin. Because they would cancel. And therefore, the conclusion is that we have one new primary of this form for each given spin. Okay. So if you represent in a plot, some CFT data associated to these two-body composite operators in the CFT. You'll have some, say, some dimension, the function of spin. And it will be some plot, like there'll be a primary at spin 2, a primary at spin 4, primary at spin 6, and so on. At each even spin, you'd have a new operator. Now, one thing we learned in the past few years in CFT is that good Reggie behavior meaning good behavior of CFT correlators, say four-point functions, in a very boosted configurations where points approach light cons, this implies that these composite-like operators are analytic in spin. And indeed, if I show you this plot and I told you that this CFT data actually belongs to some smooth analytic function in spin, I don't think you would be too suspicious. It looks plausible.
So yeah, what is the point? Are you considering general CFT in general dimensions?
This is a free theory so far. But these composite-like operators, they exist in any CFT in general dimensions, at least asymptotically for lights. But let's consider the free theory first. So, okay. So there's nothing puzzling about these two-body composite operators. Now let's ask about three-body composite operators. So now, again, using that we're looking for primaries, we can remove all the derivatives from one of the components into the other two. But now that we have two other fields, there are many ways of distributing S derivatives between them. And in fact, there are more operators the higher the spin is. And of course, you still need to mod out by permutations as you did here. And once you do that carefully, you find the following counting for primary operator as a function of spin. So you find that for spin 0, there's a single primary, which is phi cubed. Then at spin 2, there's also a single primary. At spin 4, there's a single primary. But then at spin 6, you find there are two new primaries, so there are a total of three. New primary, that's spin 6. At spin 8, it repeats 3, 3, and then at 12, you have 5, and so on. Now, conformal rate theory tells you that the CFT data associated to these operators should also be analytic in spin. But here we have a puzzle, which is that we have way more operators at high spin than at low spin. Now, the question is, how can that be compatible with analyticity in spin? Or in other words, what happens when you choose some, let's say that they organize into families like this. What happens when you follow from some high spin to some low spin, this analytic family? When it reaches this low spin region, where you would naively expect for there to be operators in the spectrum, and they are missing. Okay. So to answer this puzzle, we'll examine this question in planar n equals to 4 at weak coupling. Hey, if something is not clear, please just ask. Okay, and we will do that in n equals to 4, examining single trace operators. So what we'll do is that we'll leverage the integrability of this theory, the integrability of the CFT data of single trace operators in this theory, to generate a huge amount of data regarding this type of operators, or a slight generalization of them. And from there, we'll be able to address this question. So what we'll do is we'll look at the single trace operators of the following form, traces of a complex scalar of the theory Z, and then derivatives distributed inside the trace. This is a slight generalization of this kind of object. They're not composites of gauge invariant operators, but the same kind of questions we asked before are present here. The counting of number of primaries of this form is the same. And the output should be analytic in spin. So, okay. Now, so what do we want to do? So, all these operators have some classical dimension 3 plus spin. Okay. So, what we want to do is to, so, the operator like this plus permutations of the derivatives inside the trace. So what we would like to do is to identify which precise permutations and combinations of this type of operators are one-loop primaries in this theory. And after that, we would like to compute their CFT data to leading order in decoupling, so the one loop anomalous dimension and the leading order structure constants for these primaries. I'll tell you how that's done. So how do we compute this data? So by CFT data, I mean the anomalous dimension at one loop and some structure constant associated with some simple three-point function. So this so-called triple trace primary operators, and then some simple light operators in the theory, like a trace of z bar x and trace of z bar squared x bar, where z and x are complex scalar fields. The way we do that in integrability is that we associate to the single trace operator that we're considering, which has s derivatives and three scalar fields, we associate a spin chain of length three. So you can imagine that it z field is a site in the spin chain. And on top of it, of this spin chain, we insert excitations, which correspond to the derivatives. And these excitations move on top of the spin chain with some momenta. And the set of momenta of the excitations is parametrized by some rapidity variables, one per excitation, u1 up to us. And these rapidities, they are quantized according to some electrostatic-like equilibrium equation. So you write the quantization equation. So first, you have some interaction potential where particle ui interacts with particle uj. Then there's some constant field, which particle uj fills. And then there's a constant potential, which is 2 pi nj, where these nj are discrete. They are the quantization condition. The condition is that they are integers. They are distinct. And they belong to the interval minus s over 2 and s over 2. And finally, they sum to 0 mod 3. Then this function s is some arctangent. And so is g. OK, so what do you do? So let's first consider an example. And how do you solve this? So let's say we are looking for the primaries that spin s equal to 6. Then the mode numbers n, they belong to, they are either minus 3, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, and 3. And then we need to choose 6 out of the 7 numbers to be the mode number. So essentially, we need to choose which one we do not pick. And since they must sum to 0 mod 3, there are only three options. We can choose all but minus 3, all but 0, or all but 3. And for each of these options, we can then afterwards plug the small numbers on the electrostatic equation and then solve for the rapidities. And then from the rapidities, I'll tell you how to get the CFT data. Now, first notice that this agrees precisely with the counting I mentioned earlier. I erased already the plot. So there are three parameters at spin six. So this is how we would do the counting in integrability. Okay. So once you solve these equations for the rapidities, you can just read the energies from this, from a simple rational function, the anomalous dimensions. By energy, I mean anomalous dimension. Will just be the sum over 2 divided by uj squared plus a quarter. And then to get the structure constant, it's slightly more complicated, but not too much. What you do is that you first write down a polynomial whose roots are the rapidities. So u minus u1, dot, 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 u minus us. You build this polynomial, which is called the Baxter polynomial. And then the structure constant I described up there will be a simple ratio of factorials of spin. Times an integral over the real line of the polynomial squared divided by some hypergeometric function. Sorry, some hyperbolic cosine function, cosh pi squared. Okay, to the minus 1. So what we do is we solve this quantization problem for all possible mode numbers, for all spins up to some spin, say 200. And then we plug the result into these simple formulas. We perform some sums and some integrals numerically. And with that, we generate data, CFT data for thousands of operators in this theory with arbitrary precision, essentially.
Sir, how these numbers, yes, are correlators, are equal to single trace correlators?
Up to some geometrical factors, right? So I'm saying that that correlator, the operators, can choose them to be in some preferred conformal frame, say set one at 0, 1, and infinity, and then up to some rescaling of the operators, this is proportional to the structure cost.
So just like, I mean, take a step back, and just like you're taking a particular example where you know all of these operators, so then understand how you're encoding this, like the degeneracy of like.
Yeah, my goal is to understand how this fact that I have more operators at high spin than low spin is compatible with analyticity in spin. Or in other words, I would like to analytically continue explicitly the data of these various operators and understand what's happening as I move to the left.
But to be a little bit like, so say I was asking a question of like, let's just look at like angular momentum modes, and at higher angular momentum, I have like more orbitals, right? In a, so it's not super surprising that there's more, I guess, tensor structures you can build at higher spin, and the bigger problem is that you need to like you're worried about like it's not like you have like an analytic function with like higher order poles at these values, right? Because it's just, sorry.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is that something similar happens, in, say, even in the hydrogen atom, for example, right?
Where I find that this kernel has a larger dimension for the different values they generate.
Right. But it's still, you can ask the question of how that's compatible with analyticity in spin. We could ask this question even in the hydrogen atom. I can comment on that later. But here we're asking how it works in CFT. So now we computed all this data, and I'll show what to do next with the screen. And I have the screen.
Are they empty?
So this is the result of this extraction of anomalous dimensions as a function of spin. Here I'm plotting from spin 0 up to 60 for all operators of that of twist 3 in this theory. I'm coloring them according to their missing mode number, as we described there. So for example, the purple sequence corresponds to not using mode number 0. Then the red sequence corresponds to not using mode numbers plus or minus 3. So they are degenerate. So each red point corresponds to two operators, and therefore there are three operators at spin 6, for example. And the same holds for the green dots, where we miss mode number 6, and so on. And so you see that even before asking about how the analytic continue each trajectory, in a generic theory, you would even be confused about how do you even organize these various families into discrete trajectories. Even in n equals to 4, the answer to this question is a bit more clear, because the states are classified by this, let's say, this string mode number of these particles on the spin chain. And therefore, it's clear how to group them into families. So we have this sequence of families. Okay. And here is the structure constants in logarithmic scale. So you see they are also pretty well organized. They are exponentially decreasing functions of spin. And again, the question we'd like to ask is what happens as we continue these functions to the left. But okay, so far what all we did was to compute these huge tables of data. And the question is what do we do with that? Now, what we do is that we open Newton's Principia, particular book 3, lemma 5, case 1, in which it tells us how do you solve the problem of polynomially interpolating a sequence of points whose x-coordinates are equidistant. And he goes on explaining how you do it. It's a bit hard to read because it's very old English. But then you can translate that to modern English, and he's sort of saying the following. So suppose that you have a function f, which is holomorphic and exponentially decaying in the right half plane. So no singularities and exponentially decaying. Then the claim is that this sequence of polynomials, which are constructed only out of the values of the function at the integers, will converge to f. OK. Now let me make a bunch of remarks. So what this says is that we can reconstruct the function f from its value at the integers. Now, first comment is that being at the integer is not really crucial, right? We could, for example, rescale the argument of this function and then only use, say, the even integers, which is what we have for the CFT data. And it could even translate the argument of the function to start using only some the data starting at some high integer, let's say 50 or so on. So this seems very well suited for us to reconstruct the analytic function that governs the CFT data we just extracted. The next is that I need to specify what I mean by converges. The claim is that it converges for all z to the right of the first singularity in the complex plane. So if the function has no singularities with a real part to the right of minus 1, then this interpolation formula will converge to f up to minus 1, after real part equals minus 1. And the last point is that when I say that the function must be exponentially decaying, I'm being very strict. In fact, the function can grow exponentially in any direction in the right half plane, provided it doesn't grow exponentially as e to the azu with a too big. OK, so we can just plug the CFT data in these equations and see what the answer is. And here's the result for the anomalous dimension. It's kind of boring. It is essentially what any 5 years old would draw if you ask them to continue this sequence of points, right? But still, it's a nice check that this Newton series works. And let me make a few comments. First comment is that convergence here is very good. So here we plugged for each family All operators up to spin 200, so we have about 100 points per interpolation. So you can locate the series in the 100th term. And adding more operators makes no difference in this region. Now, on the other hand, if you only had about 10 points, then things behave very poorly as you move to the left. So having lots of operators is very important. And since having lots of operators is very important, having lots of precision is also very important. Because you have some operator of some polynomial of, say, degree 100, to make any small error, you're going to have a mess. So really, it was very important to be in n equals to 4 and have integrability to be able to generate these kinds of plots. You will never be able to do these kinds of things if you were plugging in data from, say, the conformal bootstrap or something like that. OK. The next comment I want to make is that Newton series should work under two conditions, as you mentioned. First, we should have that the function is well-behaved at large spin in all directions. In the case of the anomalous dimension in the gauge theory, this is clearly true. So these functions, they grow logarithmically. And that's well known. That's just a statement that the single trace operators at large spin, they behave as some very long strings. And long strings have energies or anomalous dimension that are proportional to their length. And their effective length is the logarithmic of the spin. So we're safe to apply Newton's methods in this case. The second point is that we should have no singularities in the right half plane. Now, that might be a bit harder to argue, because at least before you see this plot. And the reason is that naively what you'd expect is that as you continue this data, perhaps, maybe not in the real line, but in the upper or lower half plane, what could happen is that these various trajectories, they could intersect. And when the operator trajectories intersect, what you would expect is that there's some mixing of operators. And therefore, the CFT data would develop some branch points whose monodromies would mix the operators and shuffle the data around. Now, the fact that this plot converges so well sort of tells you that that doesn't happen. If it did, this plot would not converge. And in fact, you can look for what the result of this interpolation is in the upper and lower half plane, and you'll see that everything is super smooth and there are no intersections or anything like that.
But the fact that these lines are kind of just like separated from each other is probably a feature of the theory. If you had a different symmetry that like made some of these tensor structures degenerate, you would think that you'd have like...
You're saying that in other theories this could not be the case.
I don't know well enough about your
theory. It's plausible that in other setups they could mix earlier.
You mentioned the large spin asymptotic behavior. I'm also wondering the lowest spin, like when we is close to zero, do you have any analytic approximations or functions that tell you the behavior around spin zero?
Okay, so one thing I haven't told you is that if all you care about is computing the anomalous dimension for the analytic continuation of the anomalous dimension for these operators, we actually didn't need to do all this data business and Newton series and so on. Integrability provides us a way of extracting the analytic continuation of these energies directly. Why I'm going through all of this then is because what I really care about are structure constants, and we do not know how to continue structure constants from integrability. Now, the integrability result tells you that these energies around zero are all finite. And by the way, you see there are some white dots along on top of these curves. These white dots are computed using an alternative integrability method. And you see that they nicely land on top of the colorful Newton interpolation results. And so they all form each other. OK. So this was more of a check that everything is working well. Because what I really want to talk about is about the structure constants. So here I selected the data for the structure constant for the second family, the red one. So as we discussed before, there are some the data is just a monotonic sequence of decreasing exponentially decreasing values. And the question is, what happens as when it continues to the left? And the answer, once you plug it on its own series, is the following. What happens is that the analytic continuation, as you go from high spin to low spin, it keeps going up. And then suddenly, as soon as you pass the last operator, it turns around. And then it crosses the x-axis and develops a zero precisely at the even integers for which there's a missing operator in the spectrum. So this is, I think, certainly not what you would naively expect as the continuation of this exponentially decreasing sequence of numbers, right? So when we saw this, we were very excited and impressed because it really looked like magic. You just have this long table of decreasing numbers. You plug them into this interpolation formula, and it outputs this analytic function that develops zeros precisely where you would like for them to have. So this would be the resolution to the puzzle. There is nothing dramatic happening to these analytic continuations as you decrease the spin. What happens is just that precisely at the values for which you would expect these families to contribute to correlators in the theory, the structure constants develop some dynamical zeros that decouple these trajectories from contributing to correlators. Let me emphasize that these zeros are really not built in the formulas we are using. So for example, here is what happens when you use 15 operators. And then as you increase the number of operators using interpolation, you see that you get a better and better zero at the integers. Okay. And this is the result then for, say, the first five families in the theory. So we're slightly cheating in this plot because what happens is the following. If you use, for example, for the fifth family, if you use all the data that's collected and plug that in the Newton's formula, what you observe is a zero for, say, spin 22, 20, 18, 16, and 14. And then we do not have enough data for convergence to the left. But then what we do is that once we observe that these first five zeros are there and are very solid, we can then use them as extra data to this interpolation method and add them to the list of CFT data points we have. And once we impose those zeros, then we recover the next five, and so on. And in this way, we recover all of the zeros. OK, I realize I'm talking at lightning speed. So any questions so far?
Those zeros
are
involved in what you're doing.
No. So, for example, so all I do is I plug the CFT data so this trajectory starts at spin 6. I plug all the data from spin 6 to 200. I get a red curve, and the red curve has develops the zeros.
When you say the trajectory starts at spin 6, it's because you couldn't write down a tensor structure or something like that like for a spin less than 6, right? So I'm assuming that whatever you're analytically continuing just doesn't exist. Like if it didn't exist, if it wasn't zero, wouldn't there be a problem? Or no?
Yes, then you would still have a puzzle, which is how do they do not contribute to the spectrum if their structure constants are not zero and their energies are finite and they seem to be within the continuation. So yes, this is the natural explanation to the puzzle, but it's, I would say, hard to confirm. Because how do you compute analytic continue CFT data in a CFT? It's very hard usually, right?
Can you just pretend that you're doing a Newton give a number that's non-zero to the data point and do a Newton interpolation of more and see what goes wrong there?
For a second. Okay. Okay. Can I have the screen up again, please?
Benjamin.
Hi. Can I have the screen up again, please? So now we have a clear picture of what happens to these operators as you continue them from high spin to some low positive spin. Essentially, you have physical operators that start at some high even integers for each of these higher families. And then they decouple from the spectrum at precisely when they would contribute to local correlators. But then we're still it's still interesting to ask what happens as you continue further to the left. So there, we do not expect the functions, the CFT data will be analytic at all. We expect there to be a lot of singularities that should have some clear physical picture. So we expect, as we discussed already, some cuts that would correspond to mixing of these higher families with each other. They are degenerate perturbation theory, and so they can just mix right away. We could expect also some poles that would correspond to mixing if operators in perturbation theory that start with very different anomalous dimensions. So more generally, the question is, what is the full set of singularities in the left half plane, in particular, if these functions have loads of cuts, we can ask what are the monodromies, so how do these operators mix? They mix pairwise, or they mix all at the same time, or something more exotic. And these kinds of questions are related to understanding what's the systematics of, say, some Lorentzian limits in CFT. So what might be a familiar statement maybe from scattering amplitudes is that when you have some scattering amplitude, some partial wave, or some structure constant that's analytic in spin, usually the first singularity as we move to the left governs the scaling of these functions in some very boosted limit, for example, this Regge limit you described before. But if you don't care only about the leading singularity, and you really want to develop systematic expansion around these limits, you really want to understand what's the full set of singularities to the left. This is the kind of questions we would like to understand better in CFT. And for a general CFT, it's probably very realistic to start asking these kinds of questions. But in any case, so far, because of integrability, we do have the right to ask these questions and try to answer them in full generality. And that's what we are making progress towards. So I want to talk a bit about that. So the point is that integrability in principle, so let me first take a step back and say that for sure, these Newton methods are not appropriate to trying to address these kinds of questions. Because as soon as we have all these singularities, the method will not converge no matter how much data we extract. You could perhaps think that if we know the position of the singularities, we could try to apply this Newton method to some modified function where we first subtract the singularity, then we use some Newton interpolation, and then we introduce the singularity. But first, we do not know what the singularities are, and determining that is very hard from data. So we really need some more scientific method, and that method is integrability. So then I'll now describe what is this method that allows us to say compute the energies at complex spin directly from the structure of the theory instead of using data. So the key ingredient to do that, and here I'll describe how to extract energies from complex spin. We can ask about the singularity structure of energies. The key object to look at are these Baxter functions, which we just described. So I remind you, to describe the physical operators, we said that these were some polynomials whose roots are the rapidities. Okay. Now, it turns out that this polynomial, it satisfies the following equation. It satisfies that Q at U plus I, U plus I over 2 cubed, plus the same thing, complex conjugated, is equal to a polynomial that has the following structure. And Q of U. Now, this equation is, once you assume that Q is a polynomial, is nothing but the exponential of this equation. So if you exponentiate this equation, you recover this. Okay. But the key to perform analytic continuations is to forget about this statement that Q is a polynomial. This is used to describe just the local operators in the theory. If you want to analytic continue, what you need to do is that you need to look for more general solutions of this equation. And in fact, what you need to do is to look for solutions whose asymptotics are the following. So if it behaves in the real line as some exponential times u to the minus 2 minus s and some series plus u to the s and some series. So what you should do to compute the analytic continuation is to solve this equation with these generalized asymptotics under the condition that Q is an entire function. And then how do you recover the usual prescription for local operators? What happens is that when s becomes an integer, then this part vanishes, and then this becomes a polynomial again. But in general, what you should do is to look for solutions of this form. And this was a proposal that appeared about a decade or more ago by Yannick that recently understood that this prescription is related to the fact that these analytic continuations, they describe not continuations of local operators in the theory, but some dual related Wilson loops, Wilson lines, whose quantum numbers are not delta and s, but are 1 minus s and 1 minus delta. And for these operators, 1 minus delta is minus 2 minus s. So that's the origin of this kind of generalized asymptotics. And then once you solve for this equation with these asymptotics, you're done.
Why an exponential?
The exponential is required to make the function entire. But that's not a crucial requirement, because when you extract the energies, you'll see that this exponential drop. So you could remove this exponential and say that this part is exponentially suppressed or something.
So your thesis
So more generally, the claim is that we should look for the slowest growing function that's entire and solves this equation in the right half plane. Okay, and then once you have the solution, you can just compute the anomalous dimension as essentially the formula we had before. But now this solution will have infinitely many zeros, so really this will become a series. Okay. And in this way, if you just do that, we manage to reproduce everything we learned from the Newton series in the slides. On the other hand, this provides a clear way to access the left half plane. Now, the only issue is that it turns out to be very hard to solve this equation numerically as you move to the left half plane. And the reason is that there's another solution which essentially exchanges these exponents here. So you see that this function s, it intersects -2 - s at some point here. I think s equals to -1/2. So at s equal to -1, there's another solution that exchanges these two terms and starts to compute with this. And disentangling these two solutions is a bit hard numerically. But once that's done, one would have a direct access to the energies in the left half plane. And then we'll be able to address these kinds of questions. But I don't have anything to report on that yet, so maybe next time. And I'll stop here.
Any questions?
So using this, you could get three-point functions in the large space. So is that what you were?
So your question is how, after solving these kinds of equations, how do you extract the structure constants at complex spin?
Yeah.
That we do not know yet.
But what if you use the prescription you have in your SOV paper?
So that formula is not adequate to study complex spin, precisely because of these kinds of explanations I mentioned. So the naive statement is that this continuation here, once you plug in that formula, leads to divergent structure constants.
Okay.
So we'll need to learn how to generalize that formula for complex spin. Most importantly, there's an alternative way of writing this energy in a more general sense, which is that this energy is just the log derivative of q at I over 2 divided by q at u minus I over 2 evaluated at u equal to 0. Now, you see that this function, this energy, is invariant under multiplying q by an I-periodic function. And for example, an I-periodic function would be sinh of pi u. And these kinds of functions change drastically the asymptotic behavior of the Q function. Now, this means that any setup that is good to describe these analytic continuations should be insensitive to this gauge freedom of multiplying Q by these I-periodic functions, which, by the way, are a symmetry of this equation. And all SOV formulas are not.
So the interesting thing was that you were adding more and more operators, and then you're seeing it become zero rather than it's just like always zero for every like interpolation that you're doing, I guess. And you're literally just like pinning down the function at more points to the right, or you're correcting the points of a word. Sorry.
So.
Looking at figure 5 in your paper.
It's a sequence of the Newton series, a sequence of functions
yeah.
which as you increase the series, right? So as you consider more and more terms in the sequence, you have a better approximation of the function at any given point in the complex plane.
So what basically you're saying is like you already knew the values. Sorry, am I interpreting this correctly? Like you have the values of whatever.
You have the values of the data for some large pin.
Yeah, and then you're saying it becomes zero to the left of it when you put more and more to the right, right?
Yes, I mean.
That seems like a feature of just a new interpolation, right? It didn't matter what function you're matching that to, right?
Or no, for sure not, because, for example, the continuation of the energies doesn't have those zeros, right?
Okay.
Right? They're just some smooth functions that are very boring and have no zeros. And they use the same Newton interpolation formula, only with different values of f of phi.
And what happens if you decided I'm going to screw, like take one of the zeros and say, like, I'm going to do Newton's interpolation and pretend that the value is just a constant?
So what happens if I actually do an interpolation, but I say that at 4 it's actually 3?
Yeah.
Then the function behaves as a disaster here and just blows up and doesn't make any sense. So that's what I meant when I said you need lots of precision. If you change also any of the physical operators, say at spin 24, and you say that it's not 10 to the minus 6, but 10 to the minus 4, then it's a disaster. You don't recover the zeros at all. Yeah, it's a fun, this Newton series is a very fun way of playing with the rigidity of these analytic functions. It makes you respect them more. You really need some very fine-tuned things for it to work.
Is it expansion? Maybe I'm using it. Is it expansion at large past limit?
No, this is not about large. Ah, this is an expansion at large U.
Large U.
So this for fixed S, the correct function that describes the finite continuation in spin are the solutions to this equation with this asymptotic at large U.
Okay. Independent of S.
Yes, for say for S equals to 3 plus a half plus 2i. You want to look for solutions of this equation here, for which at large U they behave like that.
Any further questions? If not, let's thank Alex.
Thanks.